From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, alternative historian Michael Cesarian joins us, paying tribute to occult researcher Jordan Maxwell, who was depicted in the internet sensation Zeitgeist. Both will be on the program tonight. Last hour of last night's program, we got a call from a woman by the name of Jackie, very despondent. She said she had put a shotgun to her mouth and pulled the trigger several times. Nothing happened, thank God. And I promised I would call her back today, and I did. And she was in extraordinarily good spirits. Apparently, she had gotten a number of calls from friends and family, some of whom probably heard her on the program last night. And things are going better. She's the one who said she heard voices in her head, and she has heard none today. But she just sounded better, stronger. And we talked for a while, and she's doing well, and I wanted you all to know that. Mexican Army soldiers invaded U.S. territory and held a member of the U.S. Border Patrol at gunpoint, according to a report from the union representing the guards. The Mexican military personnel, they say, crossed over the border and pointed rifles at him, according to the union. Backup units arrived from the Border Patrol station, and then the Mexican military personnel eventually returned back to Mexico. An investigation by Judicial Watch has revealed dozens of armed incursions by Mexican soldiers and police into our country during the fiscal year of 2007. And according to a report in the Washington Times, it was unclear exactly what the Mexican soldiers were doing inside the U.S., but the report said law enforcement authorities long have said that Mexican soldiers have been hired to protect drug and migrant smugglers. It's about time we do something very tough down there around the border. Well, they do say that things are getting really hot in some portions of California, a story that we have been following on our coasttocoastam.com website with our hot stories. Truly is a hot story. As a matter of fact, the ground is so hot in one part of Southern California, it can melt the shoes right off your feet. An unexplained thermal anomaly caused a patch of land in Ventura County, just north of L.A., to reach a temperature of more than 800 degrees, baffling experts who have been monitoring the area for weeks. Dr. J.B. Tremblay is a volcanologist. JB, welcome to the show, and that's got to be pretty hot.
Hi, George, and it's RB, not JB.
Okay.
That's a Scotch, George.
That's right. How hot is this, and why?
I think it's was last measured at 812 degrees, which is pretty warm. And that's occurring in the, I think I'm pronouncing this right, it's called the Securities oil field, which is just north of Fillmore, California, in Ventura County, as you just mentioned. Now, this is thermal anomaly is actually been going on since 1980. And the reason for it is that it forms pockets of gas and tar and oil. It's on a major oil field up there, and there are fissures in the, or cracks, if you will, in the earth that allow oxygen to get in there, and it combines with these hydrocarbons, causing underground combustion in some places. So, in fact, I just had an email at the on our website here the other day on that very phenomenon.
Well, if it's 800 degrees on the surface, RB, mm-hmm. How hot is it down below?
Well, it's not much hotter. It's it would be pretty much the same temperature, give or take 15 or 20 degrees either way. But one of the questions that came up, at least on my email, and I don't know if any of your listeners have said this or not, but, you know, would this be a volcano?
A caldera type.
Yeah, like Paracutin in Mexico or
yes.
Something. And the answer is definitely not.
So there's no concern there for people that this thing's going to erupt or blow up cave in?
No. There is no immediate danger to the populace, which is quite sparse in that area anyway. But it's not a volcano about to erupt or break through the surface a la Paracutin in Mexico. That's a famous cinder cone that came up in a farmer's cornfield.
Right.
back in the 44, I think it was.
All right. Well, at least this is one story that won't have a horrible ending to it.
No, not at all. And like I said, this is a fairly common occurrence, in, especially for that particular area.
Okay, RB. Thanks for being on the program and the
Thank
update.
Thank you, George.
Okay.
Have a good time.
He's our chief volcanologist. Comes on whenever we have to talk about stories like this. That's pretty darn hot. Nine people were missing, presumed dead, four others hospitalized after a helicopter carrying firefighters crashed the night before in Northern California. Sad story. The Sikorsky helicopter had entered a remote area to pick them up. They were fighting wildfires. The mayor of Hiroshima has urged the next U.S. president to work to abolish atomic weapons as that city marked the 63rd anniversary of the world's first nuclear bombing. Some 45,000 people gathered at a memorial to the dead within sight of the A-bomb dome, a former exhibition hall burned to a skeleton by the bomb's incinerating heat. They stood up and offered silent prayers in the morning, the exact moment in 1945 when a single bomb instantly killed more than 140,000 people and fatally injured tens of thousands of others with radiation or severe burns. Of course, that day, the Enola Gay, the first aircraft to drop the atomic bomb in history. Here's the actual sound after they dropped the bomb and it exploded as they were flying away at 30-some thousand feet. And Paul Tibbetts, best known as being the pilot of the Enola Gay, and just found out he died just a short time ago, November of 2007. Army scientist Bruce Ivins was the only person responsible for anthrax attacks in 2001 that killed five and rattled the nation, according to the Justice Department, backing the claim with dozens of documents all pointing to his guilt. Documents made public allege that Ivins, who committed suicide last week, had sole custody of highly purified anthrax spores with certain genetic mutations identical to the poison used in the attacks. Now, there are some experts who say that's not the case. Investigators also said that they had traced back to his lab the type of envelopes used to send the deadly spores through the mail. A U.S. military jury at Guantanamo Bay has convicted Osama bin Laden's former driver of supporting terrorism. The verdict on Salim Hamdan is the first to be delivered in a full war crimes trial at the U.S. prison in Cuba. Well, they say that smoking can kill. Almost. A British commuter was thrown onto a railway line after she told two young people to stop smoking at a police station platform. The woman suffered burns and a broken collarbone and was taken to the hospital after the incident. Authorities say a suburban Atlanta woman died while waiting for an ambulance that a 911 operator sent to the wrong address. The Fulton County 911 director, Alfred Moore, says Darlene Dukes called 911 on Saturday for help because of difficulty breathing. The operator misheard the address and sent crews to Wells Street instead of Wales Street. The streets are 30 miles apart. They say now the average time that hospital emergency room patients have to wait to see a doctor has grown from about 38 minutes to almost an hour over the past decade. Why? Well, according to a study, more people arriving at the ERs and there are fewer emergency rooms. An Indian man who was knocked unconscious during a stampede of thousands of religious pilgrims on a steep Himalayan mountain path woke up, get this, he woke up as doctors were preparing to perform his autopsy. 19 years old, he lost consciousness in the stampede that killed 150 people. Eating broccoli, they say, could reverse the damage caused by diabetes to heart blood vessels, according to researchers in England. They found that in the vegetable, there is a compound called sulforaphane. It encourages production of enzymes which protect the blood vessels and a reduction in high levels of molecules which cause significant cell damage. In Nevada, They have confiscated from three homes more than 100 African clawed frogs, which they say are prohibited because they can pose a serious danger to native frogs. No one has been charged because they're cooperating with police, giving the frogs up. However, if they weren't cooperating, they could face up to 6 months in jail and a $500 fine. These African clawed frogs eat all kinds of native fish, amphibians, and anything else they can swallow. And they also have a deadly fungus to other frogs. On the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the DNA story about King Tut. They're checking to see whether the 19-year-old boy King fathered two offspring. Apparently, they have found two tiny mummified bodies near his tomb. And police in Florida have arrested a woman who attacked her husband with a frozen lasagna. I kid you not. And she's been charged with a few little misdemeanors there. Nissan Motors unveiled a new prototype electric vehicle with batteries twice as powerful as conventional technology. They would hope to get this car out sometime around 2010 in the United States. It's a front-wheel drive, kind of a boxy-shaped car, 80-kilowatt motor with lithium-ion batteries installed under the vehicle's floor to avoid taking up space. And what about flying cars? What's happening in that arena? In a moment, we're going to be talking with two experts from Moeller International about the latest in flying car technology. Well, we've got two guests for you this hour. First of all, Dr. Paul Moeller. He's been on the program before. He has founded the Moeller International. He serves as the company's president since its formation, professor of mechanical and aeronautical engineering at the University of California. We're talking about the flying car. That's Dr. Paul with us. Hey, Paul, welcome back.
Yes, thank you, George.
And also we've got Bruce Kelkins with us. Bruce is the general manager of Moeller International, the company that, of course, continues to design, develop, and manufacture and market personal vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. He's also written a book, which we'll talk about as well. Hello, Bruce. How are you?
Good evening, George.
Good to have you both with us. Paul, what's the latest since we last talked? I see a different kind of a car from the one I saw the last time.
Right, we really haven't changed direction. The Sky Car is still in the plans, but of course it's a FAA certified type vehicle, so it takes a lot longer to go through that process. So what we're really concentrating on immediately is what we call the 200 series, which is looks like a flying saucer, I suppose, so people can probably identify with what its appearance is, maybe like the Jetsons vehicle, and that is going to be coming out in reasonable numbers next year.
Now, the red one I'm looking at as well that we have up there on the coasttocoastam.com website looks almost like a small plane, but you can also ride it in the streets. Not for a long time, but it'll take you around, right?
Correct. Exactly. Yes.
How much are these going to go for?
Well, the 200 series is under $100,000 in modest production. The M400 is closer to $500,000 in modest production. Both of those numbers would come down significantly in volume production.
Okay, and the 200 series, again, is the one that looks like the flying saucer.
Yeah, like a Jetson machine.
Almost. How high up will that go, Paul?
Well, if you don't go over 10 feet, which is the diameter of the vehicle, then you can fly it around without a pilot's license. So you have that advantage that it's very easy to fly, and anybody can get into it. You know, a 10-year-old could fly it. I fly it, and I'm certainly not a skilled pilot. That's a special category that you can fly it. So if you're near water or muskeg or ship-to-shore operations, or in paramilitary border patrol applications. You talked about the border earlier, and we were certainly looking at that application.
But if you had to get licensed, if the FAA had to approve this, how high up would it go?
Then you could go on up to, in that vehicle, up to something in the area of 5,000 feet.
Wow.
It's not nearly as fast as the M400, but then again, it's a smaller, simpler machine the average person could actually afford.
And Bruce, let's talk about the M400 for a second. It's a beautiful looking flying car. It really is. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the Jetsons, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, doesn't it? It's a beautiful design that Paul's come up with and the rest of the team here. But it's like they say, form follows function. It's a beautiful looking vehicle, but it's also quite fast. And that's one of the reasons it looks so sleek is it is.
What is the propulsion system, Bruce, to the 400?
Well, the propulsion system is actually common between the two types of vehicles that we produce.
Okay.
It's all based on our rotary engine technology, our rotopower engine. It's a Wankel-style rotary engine. And in the Skycar, we actually use two engines in each one of the four pods that we have on the side of the vehicle, and those produce the thrust. In the 200 series, we have the eight engines distributed around the diameter of the vehicle, so it's an equal vertical thrust.
Paul, in both of these vehicles, do you have to be driving at first, picking up speed in order to take off, or how does it get up there?
No, that's of course is the tough part, and that's what's taking us so long, because you really want to rise vertically. You don't want to have a runway, and we've eliminated that through the development of these very powerful engines and some interesting ducted fan development that allows you to take off vertically. That's absolutely critical and makes it all very practical.
And it runs, a lot of this runs via computer, right?
Yeah, that's been our two big projects over the last 20 years, developing the artificial stabilization system in a redundant form so that part of it can fail and it continue to function. And also, of course, the powerful engines, which also can fail and continue to function.
In theory, let's talk about L.A. traffic for a moment. Horrendous. Everybody who lives out here knows that. Could you get into one of these, fly, you know, higher than any kind of pole that might be in the way or anything like that? So let's say you're up 100 feet and basically follow the direction of a freeway, even though, of course, they say the shortest point is the straight line. But simply follow the freeway, but you're not stuck in traffic. You're just buzzing along. How fast could you be going?
Well, the vehicle's top speed is quite high, but that's because it has a lot of power on board. Its economic speed is about 300 miles an hour at 25,000 feet or 200 miles an hour at sea level. So if you were going down the highway, typically you'd run or fly economically at 200 miles an hour.
You're still moving at that rate.
Yes.
Okay.
Economically, too.
So if you wanted to go from Sherman Oaks to Beverly Hills, for example, in L.A., you'd buzz down there. You'd probably get down there within 10 minutes, and then you just come straight down?
You come in like a normal airplane until you get near the ground, just because that's the quickest, safest approach, and then you pull the nose up, go vertical, and then land in the last 25 feet or so.
Could you hover indefinitely?
You can hover for about an hour, but when you're hovering, you're burning a lot more fuel than when you're flying. You can fly for 5 hours, but you can only hover for a little less than an hour.
Okay, and I would say, think that you'd want to just hover until you realize there was no traffic and down you'd go, right?
That's right, because, of course, hovering is probably the least safe mode of operation, so you really don't want to spend a lot of time there if something else could happen in the process.
Bruce, you've written a book. What's the name of this book? Because it talks a lot about the scientist who has discovered how to teleport people.
Yeah, my book's called Westover. And it's basically looking back at Skycar technology from the future. And so we're getting ready to get rid of Skycars and put in the next generation of transportation. In my view.
And do you think that's a reality, that we're going to be able to teleport people eventually?
Well, certainly teleportation is something that's been, you know, forecast in the science fiction era for a long time. And, you know, as we go forward in time, we find more and more of these science fiction things that have been discussed become science fact. And so I think it's quite possible that someday we'll see this as a science fact.
In an exciting sort of way, Bruce, it's sort of like 1984, George Orwell's book, except this is a little more positive about what could happen with good technology, huh?
Well, yeah, I put this in a time frame where, you know, people are enjoying the benefits of free travel like they would have with Skycars, being able to commute long distances and still live in relatively, you know, rustic surroundings. I think it's an interesting world to fantasize a little bit about and to talk about in this context.
What happens, Paul, in this case, if we're flying and something happens to the engines? I mean, are we going to crash down on somebody?
No, actually, I've had both the 200 series and the 400 series have had on occasion an engine failure, because of course we're in a developmental stage, and in neither case were there any problems. In fact, in the when I was flying the M200, I didn't even know I'd lost an engine because the computers take over so quickly. Now, obviously, you can't lose a whole bunch of engines when you're hovering. You don't have that kind of power. But the assumption is you're not going to lose more than one engine in that mode because you're not there very long. And going forward, you can lose actually 7 of the 8 engines and still continue to fly, but you won't be able to land vertically.
All right, we're going to take phone calls with you, Paul Muller, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, historian Michael Tesserian joins us along with occultist researcher Jordan Maxwell for the program. But when we come back, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Paul Muller from Muller International. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about their flying cars. Paul Muller, how quickly do these vehicles stop in the air if you had to?
Well, they have the capability of accelerating close to 1G, and they can stop at a similar deceleration. So pretty much as quick as you can stop in your car with a full brake, they can stop.
Now, Ed, do they have parachutes just in case?
Well, they do, but, you know, theoretically, of course, we do that at the beginning because we're worried about the burn-in period when you're still making it as reliable as possible. I think eventually they would not have that, but we do have that. We plan that in the test program, certainly.
And the fuel source, what do you use?
Right now we're using alcohol because it's you know, much safer in case something goes wrong. The perfect choice, perfect fuel for this vehicle.
Absolutely. Well, you've been at this for a long time, Paul. You're getting close now to getting these to market.
Yeah, the problem is we have the technology solved. The real issue is having the kinds of funding necessary to do all that reliability runs. You have to continuously test to make sure that when this product comes to market, because anything that takes off vertically, there's so many things that can go wrong. And that process is a long, very expensive process. And that's the thing that's delaying us at this time.
Are you raising the interest, though, of venture capitalists and some of these heavy hitters?
Well, venture capitalists really find something like us too long range for their support. You know, we still depend a lot on people buying our stock in the public market,
right,
or angel investors, really, who might come in and buy a large block of stock. That's really our big support.
But you're taking orders now.
We're taking orders, right.
Prominent people, names we would know, or you can't disclose that?
Well, the only one I could tell you that tried to place an order was Michael Jackson when he was quite popular, and we thought, well, you know, if he goes out and gets himself killed, we're going to be in big trouble. But I guess today, with his being less popular, it wouldn't be so dangerous to sell him.
Well, does he have the money to do it?
That's a good question, too.
Let's go to some of the calls. West of the Rockies, Tim in Washington, you're on the air with us. Hey, Tim, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. It's going great. Thanks.
Hey, actually, that was kind of answering my question. Is I was asking how I can buy one of these cars.
Yeah, talk about which one would you be interested in, Tim? The 200 version, which looks like a flying saucer, or the bigger one, which seats how many, Paul? Four?
Four people.
Four
yes.
people.
And the 200 version seats two or just one?
Two people, side by side.
So you can go on a date, Tim.
Yeah, well, I guess that'll be my choice.
Sure, it's coming out next year, whereas the 400 is probably not until 2011.
All right, so what's the process if you want to buy or at least put down a deposit on a 200?
You don't even have to put down a deposit. All you have to do is send in your desire to buy it, and we do send out a qualification because, of course, we have to know who's buying it, and you just... Not anybody initially would want. You didn't want just anybody flying it. You'd like to see them with some preparation in that. So
you don't have to have a pilot's license or anything like that.
Don't have a pilot's license, and you just need to qualify and then get your name on the list. And then when it becomes available, you'll be notified.
What about financing? Do you have favorite banks that are
We haven't arranged that yet because we haven't reached the point of actually selling them. But as we get closer to that, you know, actually delivering the vehicles or getting ready to deliver the vehicles, we certainly will arrange some financing to help.
And what do you think, you know, like a car, people change them, you know, whenever they want, but I mean 3 years, 5 years. What do you think the life would be of one of these vehicles?
Well, I think it's like the airplane business. They last forever pretty much. You know, airplanes, you go buy a light plane today, it probably sells for 50% more than it sold when it was originally sold.
So you might be able to get 10-year financing from a bank.
Yes,
if you set this thing upright.
Right. The cars depreciate about 10% per year. Aircraft depreciate, in the worst case, about 2% per year.
I'm envisioning now my own fleet of flying cabs in L.A. and St. Louis. and they'd be at the airport waiting for people.
That's exactly the vision that, one of the companies, Boeing, came about when they studied the sky car. They called it air taxi on demand.
Wouldn't that be incredible?
I think it's where we might actually start out in fairly large numbers, quite frankly.
I think so, too. That is amazing. I wonder what the how much would you charge a customer to fly from LAX to, like, Beverly Hills or something?
Well, we haven't figured that out. The only thing that Boeing was able to establish in their study is that it would be less expensive than jet aircraft, and it would get you there faster because you wouldn't have a waiting list. And they did the study long before we got into the present problems.
I guess they couldn't get you for a speeding ticket, could they?
No, sir.
What was that? East of the Rockies, Randy in Kansas. Go ahead, Randy.
Yes, sir, Mr. Mulder. Thank you very much for your dedication to your work. It's awesome.
Thank you.
As a rated pilot, will this require a rotorcraft rating? And at gross weight with a 12.5 LD, what speed is required to get the best lift-drag ratio in an engine-out situation? And what about the CG range? Go ahead. I'll listen.
Well, I'll answer that. The CG range, we haven't got it completely defined, but it's quite broad because we have such a large ability to generate lift at different points in it. When you ask for the speed range for maximum lift drag ratio with engine out, that's 135 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's workable. Thank you.
Okay. Next up, let's go to New Mexico. First-time caller, Umberto. Hi there.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're doing great. Thanks.
Cool. I wanted to ask about if I were to purchase one of these vehicles, if you would need a special kind of insurance to fly one, if it'd be possible to, I don't know, if they get popular and they're available to the public.
That's a good question.
They could maybe make a highway system, you know, above the highways we have now. I mean, I don't know if you need clearance for airspace and travel and whatnot, but
how would your friendly insurance company insure this?
Well, everything is going to depend on established reliability. And if there's any been one criteria that's top of our list is reliability. We have a level of redundancy in our electronics and in our engines to ensure that it's, you know, nothing's ever foolproof, but as foolproof as you can make it. So I think if we can establish the type of reliability that we've built into this system, insurance will follow, and it'll be reasonable.
How did the idea for this car come about, Paul?
Well, I was a 5-year-old growing up on a mountain in Canada trying to get to school in the middle of winter, and I said, there's got to be a better way. and the Hummingbird was my inspiration, and I've been pushing in that direction ever since.
Isn't it amazing that you're just so close now to getting these things to market, finally?
Well, we depend on other technologies, as you well know, George. We the electronics industry has helped us enormously with these low-cost components. And, of course, engines depend on exotic materials or materials that are inexpensive but strong, and that's been important for us as well.
Could these cars happen without computers?
No. No, absolutely not. I would say maybe, you know, one of the astronauts might be able to fly it for a short period of time if he did a lot of training. But for the average person, absolutely not.
Because I noticed in some of your material, you really don't have to do a lot other than steer the thing, right?
That's correct. That's correct. The computers provide all of the artificial stabilization for the vehicle, and that's becoming pretty common in most of the military aircraft today, but it's not yet in much of the civilian aircraft.
Do you have autopilot? What happens, for example, if something happens to the person who's flying the thing? You get sick.
Well, you could certainly put an autopilot because it has all the ability to do that. We haven't actually put that function in there, but it's a relatively small step to do so because it really is, as you say, it flies itself. And so if you had a condition where if something goes wrong, it just would take you down at a certain rate and land you.
Okay, next up, Joe in Massachusetts. Long time, Joe.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good.
I want to thank you for giving out my email last time. I got some real nice listeners from coast to coast, no cranks and anything. And when I call you back next month, I'll talk to you more about that and ask for some other things because you're very nice. And I'm still having medical problems, but doing my best, like I said, Tom. Paul, question for you. I'm the blind fellow who spoke with you a few months ago, actually a few years ago. You said you wanted to see blind people fly these things. Is that coming possible? And that little car, why don't you make them both so they'll both go high, you know, like 25 or 30,000 feet?
Well, Well, the series, the 200 series can go high, but the difference is you need a Potter's license when you do that. It still won't be able to go to the heights of the M400 because the M400 has big wings.
Well, are you going to correct that? Because remember how you said you're going to make it almost foolproof so that anybody, a blind person, because I talked to you and you sent me the video a long time ago, blind person could have,
sure.
A lot of people aren't going to get pilot license. They're going to have to come up with like airwaves and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
At some point, yeah, you're covering a lot of ground there because right now we offer the M200 and everybody could fly it, including a blind person, quite frankly.
Okay, how high does that go?
That goes, if you have a pilot's license, that can go up to about 5,000 feet. If you don't have a pilot's license, you can't fly it above 10 feet.
Well, but if you had to get above 10 feet, you would. I mean, it's kind of crazy. But does it have radio communications and oxygen and everything?
Well, that one wouldn't need it because it's geared, the 200 series is for 5,000 feet.
Yeah, you can't go up much higher than that.
But if you lose power, how will you avoid crashing? Do they all have wings so they can glide a little bit?
No, but they do have built-in parachutes, number one. And number two, they have multiple engines and multiple computers. They have four computers working at the same time, talking to each other, deciding who's not telling the truth. And it has eight engines. It can function with an engine failed in hover or more than one engine if it's going forward.
Yeah, what's the worst case scenario, Paul, in terms of having to land, how many engines can go out and you're still okay?
Well, if you have a runway available to you, you can land with only one engine functioning, but that's a pretty high-speed landing. If you have four of the eight engines running, you can land at about 45 miles an hour on a regular runway, but you still have to have some space to land it. I think I would advise someone, if that happened, to pull the parachute.
Okay, you would. And would it come down flat, or does it come down like on its side and you're, you know, facing almost down?
No, it comes down. It comes down with the back end down first because that absorbs a lot of the energy when it hits. You don't want to come down absolutely flat because that's a real smackdown.
Okay, so you're kind of like looking up toward the parachute,
right,
as you're coming,
right,
down.
You're praying like crazy. You're going to do some damage to the back end of the vehicle, but that's part of the emergency process.
Okay, and you don't have any control where you land when you pull the parachute?
No, not with the present vehicles, but there's every possibility that we can give them some glide capability with a different design.
Right. I mean, they may end up landing on a house or something, right?
That's possible, but we don't think anybody's going to crash it.
Lynette in Texas, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Lynette. Go ahead.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
My question is, why haven't any metropolitan police officers or, you know, police departments contacted you? It sounds something perfect for traffic control, emergency situations, and plus it's sort of inadvertent advertising, if you will.
Well, we have talked to the fire departments in particular because the vehicle can come up to the side of a skyscraper and pick somebody up. And that would be a real asset where a helicopter can't do that. And we are certainly talking to Border Patrol people and that kind of application. We actually haven't talked to the police yet, but we've got our hands filled with enough interested parties in the military that we're pretty much preoccupied.
I think I'd just like to go around 200 feet up in the air and just travel down the road and not have to wait for stop signs and stop lights and just keep going.
Well, that's the world tomorrow, I guarantee you.
And it's doable. Sounds like the 200's easier to do that than the 400.
It's just quicker, and you can do it with a lot less expensively. But ultimately, if you want to go, you know, 300 miles an hour instead of 100 miles an hour, you're going to have to go to the 400.
What's it look like on the inside of these things?
Well, it's pretty much like a modern airplane, except there's it's a pretty much electronic cockpit. Distinct from the small airplanes today, it's probably more like the jet plane with the all-electronic cockpit.
Are they noisy, Paul?
Well, they're reasonably noisy just simply because we haven't made a concentrated effort on muffling yet. It's another element of the development process. We know how to make them quiet. We just haven't had the time nor the money to concentrate on that.
To do it. But the finished versions probably will have some kind of muffler system.
Absolutely. They're muffled right now. We just don't muffle the fans. Eventually, we're going to muffle the fans as well.
Martin in Washington. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Yeah, hi. I'm going to make this quick. My phone is about to die.
Okay.
I'm going to get my questions on or not. I'll make them real quick and again, keep my answer off the air. Regarding the graph that's actually pictured on the website tonight, three questions. One of them is I'd like to know yes or no if the cooling system is actually for all the engines is actually inside or is actually the heat is dissipated in the fan cowlings or not. And secondly, I was thinking that maybe one of these, I'd like to know if one of these machines is going to have be smart enough to keep the non-pilot out of the different classes of airspace that they probably shouldn't be in. The third question I was wondering is, would it be possible down the road to, or at any time, to be able to maybe install some VHF auxiliary, like cam gear or something like that? Anyway, thanks, guys. Go ahead.
Certainly, the answer to the first question is that the cooling systems are all independent, in the sense each engine has its own cooling system in the nacelle, so it doesn't get into the cockpit at all. And the second question was what again? It was the...
He's talking about some kind of range with that, which I didn't understand. But his third question was about the VHF?
Yeah, well, I mean, the VHF, that would be standard. I mean, this vehicle is way beyond VHF. He talked about the issue of autopilot. This vehicle
right.
is naturally an autopilot vehicle because that's the way it's designed in the first place. It's not like an accessory. It's, as you said earlier, it's absolutely necessary that this thing be stabilized by artificial stabilization. And if you're going to be able to do that electronically, you've got everything you need for every kind of flying that you can imagine.
You'd like 40 units of the 200 version to come out next year?
That's our plan. We've got our first four complete, the airframes complete for our first four, and we're speeding up the process. We expect to produce 40 next year.
Al in California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Al.
Yeah, I got a pretty good question for you.
Right.
It seems like I remember back in the 50s in the comic books, there was a sky car that looked like your 400 series for about $5,000. Is
Don't
that
I
the
wish.
Same company?
No, we weren't around in the 50s. I think you didn't see anything like our sky car until the late 80s when we were showing it a little bit. We hadn't flown it yet. We flew it actually first in the mid 90s, just briefly, and then most of the test flying occurred after the year 2000.
You call the 200 the Jetson?
Well, it's sometimes people call it that because it looks so much like it.
You never know. That was a great cartoon series, wasn't it?
It certainly was.
Let's go to Glenn in Texas, east of the Rockies. Final question. Go ahead, Glenn.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Dr. Miller.
Hi.
Good morning.
Dr. Miller, you were featured in Omni magazine in the mid-80s, correct?
That's correct.
I could have a plethora of questions, such as a design lifting body, how long has a Wankel run with the impeller attached on a test bed, and so forth and so on. But I'll just stick with one. I was just wondering how you could talk of sales, let alone manufacturing, if we haven't seen these at air shows, let alone you've run one off the test bed. Thank you, and I'll listen on the
end. All right, sure thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's why the M400 is not going to be available until the year 2011, because it's a complicated aircraft than probably the traditional sense of aircraft. The M200 is not going to come out as an aircraft initially, as I said. It's going to be a ground effect machine, which puts you in a regime where you're not so worried about some of those things that you have to deal with before you sell the product. So we've demonstrated it in ground effect. A lot. We demonstrated out of ground effect. We're selling it as an in-ground effect machine initially and getting experience there. But most of our sales in it probably go to the paramilitary, because that's a far safer way to introduce it when you're starting out rather than actually sell it to the commercial market at the beginning.
What's the material? Carbon fiber? Steel? What is it?
No, it's all fiberglass on the 200 because that's an inexpensive machine. It's all carbon fiber on the 400.
Okay, very good. Paul, thank you. Good luck. Let's stay in touch, okay?
You're welcome. Appreciate
Paul
the opportunity to talk with you.
The flying car. One day. Back in a moment with Michael Tesserian and Jordan Maxwell on Coast to Coast AM.